Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 26, verses 23 through 35. We're going to discuss Isaac's treaty with Abimelech of Gerar. Our context is this. In the first part of chapter 26, we see Isaac living in Gerar, having gone there because of a famine and lying about his wife, Rebekah. He called her his sister, and that worked out nicely because Abimelech did not violate Rebekah in any way. And so now, here in the second part of chapter 26, we begin at verses 23, 24, and 25. Then he went up from there to Beersheba, that's Isaac. The Lord appeared to him the same night and said, I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham. So he built an altar there. That's Isaac built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants dug a well. Now he went up from there, that's Gerar, to Beersheba. If you look at the map, Gaza is on the southeastern corner of the Mediterranean Sea on the coast there at southern Israel. If you draw a diagonal line at a 45-degree angle, going from northwest to southeast from Gaza, and go about 10 miles or so on that line, and you'll hit Gerar. Go another 20 miles or so, and you hit Beersheba. And Beersheba was halfway between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea, and it was about a third of the way up from the bottom of the Dead Sea. So that's kind of the area where we are now. Now, of course, Beersheba was a place that Abraham had been living there before for a long time, and that's where he took Isaac from after he almost sacrificed him on Mount Moriah up in Jerusalem. And if you recall, Abraham had made a covenant with his Abimelech of Gerar, probably a different Abimelech. And they made a covenant there, and they call the place Beersheba. Beer is well, and Sheba either means oath or seven. And so it could mean well of seven, because Abraham set out seven ewe lambs to mark the occasion. Or it could be well of the oath, because Abraham made an oath with Abimelech of Gerar. So that's why Beersheba was called Beersheba. And it was the stomping grounds of Abraham, so it's not surprising that Isaac left from Gerar and went back to Beersheba, another 20 miles or so away from Gerar. So we assume the famine is now over, because that's why he left Beersheba to start with, to go to Gerar. Now, as I just said, Isaac and his father formerly lived there, as John Gill also says. We read in Genesis 21, verse 33, Abraham planted a tamarisk tree at Beersheba, and there he called on the name of the Lord, the everlasting God. Now let's look at some interesting facts from Easton's dictionary about Beersheba. As I said earlier, it's the well of the oath, or well of seven, a well dug by Abraham, and so named because he and Abimelech here entered into a compact. On reopening it, and that's interesting because now apparently the well has been filled up. This is 60, 90, 100 years later when Isaac gets there. And Easton points out that Isaac reopens that well. We'll see how we know that in just a minute. Isaac gave it the same name, Beersheba. It was a favorite place of abode for both of these patriarchs. It is mentioned among the cities given to the tribe of Simeon upon the distribution of the land in Joshua. From Dan to Beersheba, a distance of about 144 miles, became the usual way of designating the whole promised land. It passed into a proverb. After the return from the captivity, that's in 537 BC or so, the phrase is narrowed into from Beersheba unto the Valley of Hinnom, because that's all that was left of Israel, the southern part of it, and the Valley of Hinnom is in Jerusalem in the south. The name is not found in the New Testament. It is still called, i.e. in the 19th century, by the Arabs, Well of the Seven. All right, so we need to know about Beersheba. It's a well-known place in the Old Testament. Now, the Lord, Yahweh, appeared to Isaac and said, I am the God of your father Abraham, do not fear. Now, why would God be telling Isaac not to fear? Because it was a time of stress. There's already been a famine, and now Isaac goes to Gerar and ends up competing with the herdsmen of Gerar over wells. It's like competing over gold mines. So there was conflict with Abimelech of Gerar, and Isaac's under stress. And this illustrates a point, I think, is that God will give his visions at times of stress, important times in the course of redemptive history. I can give you lots of examples, but this is one of them right here. Paul had a dream, the Macedonian call. Should I stay here and Asia? Should I go over to Europe? What should I do? And God gave him a vision. He had a vision when he was in the Antonia fortress at the end of the third missionary journey, when he had almost been killed by a riot. And God said, be faithful to the heavenly vision. So on and on and on. You'll see this when there's times of trouble. How about Paul and his companions in the Philippian jail? I think it was Silas that was with him. Acts 16, Paul and Silas, Philippian jail. All of a sudden, angels appear. We can't expect that kind of divine visitation every day. It happens rarely. And when we read the Bible, we tend to telescope events together, and it sounds like it's happening all the time. Actually, the ancients were just as surprised by angelic visitors as we would be. They were more open to it because we're rationalist and we're biased, but they were surprised when they saw it because it didn't happen every day. But at any rate, God appeared to Isaac. We don't know how. Again, dream, vision, epiphany, theophany. Jesus appears as an angel. Who knows? Now, God repeats this promise that had been made to Abraham. I will bless you and multiply your descendants, God says to Isaac, for the sake of my servant Abraham. That means because of the covenant promises that he had earlier made to Abraham, which promises consisted of land, offspring, and blessing. L-O-B, lob, land, offspring, and blessing. Only the offspring blessing is repeated here to Isaac. Let's look at some of those offspring promises that God had earlier made to Abraham. Genesis 12, verses 2 through 3. This is upon leaving Haran, going to the Holy Land. And I will make you a great nation, God says, and I will bless you and make your name great, and so you will be a blessing. That's mainly the blessing promise. But the first part, I will make you a great nation, that means that's offspring. Genesis 13, 14 through 17. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, now lift up your eyes and look for the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land which you can see, I will give it to you and to your descendants forever. So there's your offspring, descendants. Descendants is just another name for offspring. I will make your descendants, your offspring, as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, which they can't, then your descendants can also be numbered. Your offspring can also be numbered. Genesis 15, 18, this is when Abraham cut the covenant with God with the pieces of the animals. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land, your offspring, from the river of Egypt as far as the great river of the river Euphrates, so the descendants will have the land. Genesis 17, this is at the covenant ceremony, the covenant, well, it was a repetition of the covenant in Genesis 15, really, but at that time, the ordinance of circumcision was established. And God says to Abraham, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you will be the father of a multitude of nations. Just drop down here to verse 7, Genesis 17. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and to your descendants after you. Verse 8, I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings. And Genesis 22, after Abraham had not sacrificed Isaac on Mount Moriah. Genesis 22, verses 17 and 18. Indeed, I will greatly bless you. I will greatly multiply your seed. Seed's the same thing as offspring, same thing as descendants, depending on the translation. I will greatly multiply your offspring as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your seed, your offspring, shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. So you see, this promise of descendants is a huge theme of Genesis. And it's repeated to Isaac right here. I imagine Isaac might have been concerned about the promise being carried forward through his line, because after all, I'm sure Isaac heard about this promise through his father Abraham. I'm sure that was a part of family folklore by that time. And so he might be thinking, this famine here, this might wipe us out. I'm not sure how this is going to work out, how we're going to have a bunch of descendants. So God appears to him and repeats the promise. It's always good to have God repeat a promise to you. It's always good to read an old scripture that you haven't seen for a while, and you say, yes, God promised me that, and I know he's going to do it, because he's done it before. Verse 25, so he, Isaac, built an altar there at Beersheba and called upon the name of the Lord. That's what you do when you sacrifice on an altar. You call upon the name of the Lord. You pray to him. And Isaac pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants dug a well. We go now to Genesis 26, verses 26 through 29. Then Abimelech came to him from Gerar with his advisor Ahuzath and Phicol, the commander of his army. Isaac said to them, why have you come to me, since you hate me and have sent me away from you? If you recall, in the last audio, there was a lot of conflict between Abimelech and Isaac. And Abimelech said, look, why don't you leave town? And Isaac did. They were fighting over those wells. There was also the problem that Isaac had lied about Rebekah being his wife. And so there was bad blood between them. And Isaac said, what have you come before? Why have you come to me since you hate me and have sent me away from you? Verse 28, they, that's Ahuzath and Phicol, said, we see plainly that the Lord has been with you. So we said, let there now be an oath between us, even between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you, that you will do us no harm, just as we have not touched you and have done to you nothing but good and have sent you away in peace. Now that's diplomatic language. In other words, it's full of bull, if you want to look at it exactly, but that's what they said. You are now the blessed of the Lord, says Phicol and Ahuzath to Isaac. All right, who is this Phicol? If you remember, Abraham had made a similar treaty with Abimelech 60 years earlier at the same place, Beersheba. Well, the NIV Study Bible says it was 60 years earlier. John Gill says it was 100 years earlier. Adam Clark says it was 90 years earlier. I don't know. These genealogies and dates will drive you crazy, but so let's say it was over half a century ago that a similar treaty had been made between Abraham and Abimelech. Well, that's probably a different Abimelech because it's so long later, you assume that Abimelech had a son, maybe even a grandson. Abimelech is a title given to the kings of Gerar, like Pharaoh is a title given to the kings of Egypt. And Phicol is probably the same thing. It could be a family name, so this is Phicol Jr., because there was a Phicol at Abraham's treaty with Gerar, and there's a Phicol here with Isaac's treaty with Gerar. It could be a military title, actually, like general. Let's take a peek back at Abraham's deal with Abimelech, Genesis 21, verses 22 and 23. At that time, Abimelech, accompanied by Phicol, the commander of his army, said to Abraham, God is with you in everything you do. Swear to me by God here and now that you will not break an agreement with me or with my children and descendants. As I have been loyal to you, so you will be loyal to me and to the country where you are a resident alien. All right, verse 27, Isaac responds to the ambassadors from Abimelech. He says to them, why have you come to me since you hate me and have sent me away from you? He's probably thinking, are you coming here to give me some bad news? Or if you're coming here to make a deal with me, why do you want to make a deal with me? You hate me. Well, the answer to that is probably Abimelech figured he better make peace with Isaac because Isaac just keeps on getting wealthier and wealthier and stronger. Plus, he knew he had done personal injury to Isaac. He had run him out of Gerar. He had not protected Isaac against the injustice of the Gerar herdsmen. The herdsmen had stopped up Isaac's wells, and Abimelech had done nothing about it. Now, John Gill, in Abimelech's defense, says that perhaps it's possible that Abimelech had not heard of what his herdsmen had done in stopping up the wells. John Gill suggests that, but I have a hard time believing that Abimelech had not heard that his herdsmen had stopped up Isaac's wells. He knew. So he probably figured, hey, I better get this powerful neighbor of mine on my side and make a treaty with him, because Isaac had become very strong and very rich. Now, listen to this diplomatic language that Phicol and Ahuzath said to Isaac. As we have not touched you and have done to you nothing but good and have sent you away in peace. Well, now that's quite a positive spin. Is actually a damnable lie, if you really think about it, because they'd run him out of town. They'd run Isaac out of town, these herdsmen of Gerar. Now they're saying, we've done nothing but good. We haven't touched you. John Gill says again in Abimelech's defense, or in the ambassador's defense, Abimelech could have attacked Isaac on Isaac's way out, and he didn't do it. So maybe that's what they were referring to. But let's put it this way. If they didn't lie, they put a pretty positive spin on their dealings with Isaac. Well, that's diplomacy. That's not surprising. That's the way diplomats talk. We go now to Genesis 26, verses 30 through 33. Then he, Isaac, made them, that's Phicol and Ahuzath, the ambassadors from Abimelech of Gerar, Isaac made them a feast, and they ate and drank. In the morning they arose early and exchanged oaths. Then Isaac sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. Now it came about on the same day that Isaac's servants came in and told him about the well which they had dug, and said to him, we have found water. So he called it Sheba. Therefore the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. Now in the New American Standard Version, the Sheba, Isaac called it Sheba, is spelled S-H-I-B-A-H in the English, and the Sheba in Beersheba is S-H-E-B-A, so it's spelled differently, but it's pronounced the same. And so I'm going to assume this is the same place, the same well. Well, let's go back to verse 30. Then Isaac made them a feast. That feast could have been a feast that was in connection with a covenant, because meals were very typical when covenants were made, and I suspect that's what that was. It could be it was a feast not in connection with a covenant, a separate feast to show generosity and hospitality, but I don't think so. All right, so they made the treaty. Isaac didn't want to fight. He was not a person that got into fights all the time. We already pointed out in the previous audio that when there was conflict, he first moved from Gerar to the Valley of Gerar outside of town to avoid conflict, and then now he's retreated all the way to Beersheba. He didn't want to fight. He wanted peace. So his servants, after the on the same day as this of this feast, which was probably a covenant feast, Isaac's servant says, "Hey, we found water." Now, you found water in those arid desert lands, that's a big deal. And so naturally, it would be like this, as Isaac's servants probably came rushing in and said, "Hey, Isaac, we got water, water, water." It's like when in Oklahoma and Texas, when they found oil and the oil went up and everybody goes crazy with joy. That's probably how they were behaving there as they came in to tell Isaac. Now, Sheba means oath or seven. As we know, Beersheba is well of the oath or well of the seven. Well, the seven would refer to the seven ewe lambs that Abraham had set out. But Isaac is confirming the name of Beersheba, really. He called it Sheba. And we probably need to take Sheba as oath there because of the oath that he made with his Abimelech of Gerar. And this is how Easton's dictionary knows that it was Abraham's well that was redug, not a new one. It's because of the name Sheba. Although, to be honest with you, I'm not sure Easton's can prove that with 100% certainty. It might have been or it might not have been, in my view. But anyway, we'll say it's the same well, a well of the oath. Beersheba, by the way, is a great place to go see it because it was so well known in Old Testament history, and it's also known in modern Israeli history because Ben-Gurion lived there. And his house is preserved there as a museum. I think there's a university there, and it's beautiful. It sits on a Ben-Gurion's tomb is there, and you can stand on the edge of this beautiful valley there, and it's well watered. I mean, it's got trees and leaves, even though it's in a desert. But then you look out over the hill, and you see desert for as far as the eye can see. So it's a really nice place, both historically and now, to go see. Now, here's a translation issue in verse 33. The New American Standard Bible says, "So he, Isaac, called it Sheba, so because they found water there." But the problem with that is that why he called it Beersheba? No, he's called it Beersheba because Abraham had already named it Beersheba. And the town had been called Beersheba from Abraham's time. We read in Genesis 21:31, "Therefore he, Abraham, called that place Beersheba because there the two of them took an oath." Well, the NIV translates it a little bit differently and it doesn't create that confusion. The NIV says, "And to this day the name of the town has been Beersheba." Not because of this the name of the town has been Beersheba. We go to Genesis 26, verses 34 and 35. "When Esau was 40 years old, he married Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah." Now, 40 years old, he gets married. It seems kind of late, but remember, they lived a long time back then. This is the same age that his father Isaac got married. Now, Esau has got two wives here, Judith and Basemath, both of them Hittites. He also married someone in his own family, Mahalath, I guess is how you pronounce it, M-A-H-A-L-A-T-H. We read that in Genesis 28:9, "And Esau went to Ishmael and married, besides the wives that he had, Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebaioth." Nebaioth, if I remember correctly, is Ishmael's oldest son, and he had a sister. Nebaioth had a sister named Mahalath. So basically, Esau married his first cousin. Esau's father was Isaac. Isaac's half-brother was Ishmael, and Ishmael's daughter was Mahalath, and so that's his first cousin. So he married two Hittites and one of the family. Now, we have a harmony problem here, because in Genesis 36, there's a genealogy which only mentions Basemath as the three wives of Esau. That genealogy mentions Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Oholibamah, the daughter of Anah the Hivite, as well as the same Basemath here. So we got two that don't match. Here's some possible reconciliations. The NIV Study Bible suggests that perhaps the list have suffered in transmission. Might be textual problems, in other words. Or it could be that alternate names or nicknames are used. NIV Study Bible suggests, or it could be that Esau married more than three wives, as the NIV Study Bible and John Gill suggest. It's nothing to worry about. It has nothing to do with inerrancy, in case you were thinking that. Now, these two daughters of Hittites, Judith, the daughter of Beer the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, so we'll just call them Judith and Basemath, married Esau, and they caused a lot of trouble in the household. It says in verse 35, they brought grief to Isaac and Rebekah. Now, Isaac and Rebekah were determined not to let Jacob make the same mistake that Esau had made. Esau was, you know, he was a screw-up, let's face it. He despised his birthright, you know the story. And now he's married a bunch of pagan women. Now, Isaac and Rebekah did not want Jacob, Esau's brother, to make the same mistake. They didn't want Jacob to marry a Hittite or Canaanite woman. We read in the next chapter, Genesis 27, verses 46, all the way to chapter 28, verse 2, the following. Rebekah said to Isaac, I am tired of living because of the daughters of Heth, that's the Hittites, Judith and Basemath. I'm tired. She didn't want to live anymore because of these people. If Jacob takes a wife from the daughters of Heth, from the Hittites like these, from the daughters of the land, what good will my life be to me? It's not worth living. Tired of living. What good is it going to be to live if you have daughters-in-law like that? I mean, they must have been real pieces of work, because she's really depressed here. So Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, you shall not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Oh, that's such good advice. I got to stop here and make an application. If you're a young Chinese single Christian girl and your parents are saying if you get to be 30 and you're not married yet, you have disgraced the family, you've destroyed the genealogies, and you haven't given us the descendants, and you are a piece of trash. And so some young man who's got a computer science degree, he's making money hand over fist, and he's just as atheist or pagan or unbelieving as he can be, and you want to marry him? Just remember what Rebekah said to her husband Isaac. I'm tired of living because of these pagans, and you're going to get tired of living too. You marry somebody like that, you made the dumbest mistake in your life. And I know lots of Chinese women that have done that. And I suppose, I know American women too, people my age that have done it and ruined their lives. I can think of two right now. Don't take a wife from the daughters of America, from the daughters of the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah. Don't take a wife from the pagans of China. Don't do that. Take a wife from your spiritual family, the Church of Jesus Christ, and you'll have a chance at a happy life. So Isaac continues to tell Jacob here in Genesis 27, or 28 now, arise, go to Padam Aram, that's Syria near Haran. Arise, go to Padam Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father. Isaac's mother was Rebekah, and Rebekah's mother was Bethuel, if you recall. And from there, take to yourself a wife from the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother, your uncle Laban. And so Isaac was very careful. Don't marry the people around here. No Hittites, no Canaanites. Get out of here and find somebody in the family where there's less chance of paganism destroying the family. Now, Isaac went to a lot of trouble to get Jacob to marry a proper woman, a believer in Yahweh. Abraham had done the same thing to keep Isaac from marrying a pagan. Remember, he sent his servant to Nahor, or Haran, depending on how you read it, to find a wife, Rebekah, for Isaac, to find a wife, who turned out to be Rebekah, for Isaac. Genesis 24:3, and I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of earth, that you, he's talking to his servant, Eliezer probably, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I live. So there is a great Old Testament example of don't be unequally yoked. It's the dumbest mistake you can ever make to marry a pagan. All right, let's wrap up a few loose ends here. These two Hittite daughters-in-laws, who are the Hittites? Well, they show up a lot in Scripture, so we'll look at them a little closer here. I'm going to pick and choose from Easton's dictionary. The Hittites inhabited the whole region between the Euphrates and Damascus. Now, this is probably at the tail end of the Hittite Empire. Well, first of all, let me give you some dates. The Hittite Empire was mainly in Turkey, present-day Turkey, the Anatolian Peninsula. And Wikipedia has their dates from 1600 to 700 BC, about, approximately. Another website I found called the HittiteEmpire.Weebly.com has them from 1700 BC to 700 BC. But by the time you get past 1200 or so, they start breaking up into many Hittite empires, and they finally get assimilated, I think by Assyria mainly, But at the end there, they had curled all the way around out of Turkey, out of the Anatolian Peninsula, and they had curled down into Syria and come down all the way down. They were hanging around in Israel. Remember Uriah the Hittite? So they were all over the place. Their empire, however, was in Turkey. All right, so if the Hittites were from 1600 to 700 B.C., and Esau was born in 1836 B.C., they are roughly contemporaneous. Because, of course, Esau's going to live, let's say, I don't know how long Esau lived, but let's say he lived 100 years, that'd put him up into 1736, was just about the time the Hittite Empire got started, and I assume that they were Hittites that weren't a part of the empire before the empire got going. They were still members of the Hittite race. So, those dates are so iffy, so speculative, they're so imprecise because ancient dating can drive you crazy, but that's roughly the time period here. So there were Hittites in Syria, as Easton says, chief cities being Carchemish on the Euphrates, famous city, Kadesh, another famous city, because of the Battle of Kadesh there. These Hittites seem to have risen in great power as a nation. For a long time, they were formidable rivals of the Egyptian and Syrian empires. Of course, they're very famous in ancient history. In the book of Joshua, they appear as the dominant race to the north of Galilee. Joshua's down about 1200 or so B.C., and the Hittites are still there north of Galilee. They are first referred to in Scripture in the history of Abraham, who brought from Ephron the Hittite the field and cave of Machpelah. They were then settled at Kiriath Arba, which is Hebron. From this tribe, Esau took his first two wives, that's the two we just talked about, Judith and Basemath. They are afterwards mentioned in the usual way among the inhabitants of the Promised Land. They were closely aligned to the Amorites. That was another huge tribe up there around Lebanon and Syria. They are frequently mentioned along with them as inhabiting the mountains of Palestine. When the spies entered the land, they seem to have occupied with the Amorites the mountain region of Judah. So the Hittites were around. They took part with the other Canaanites against the Israelites. After this, there are a few references to them in Scripture. We do know of Ahimelech the Hittite in 1 Samuel 26:6 and Uriah the Hittite. That was the military officer that David managed to murder, unfortunately. In the days of Solomon, the Hittites were a powerful confederation in the north of Syria and were ruled by kings. Solomon's in the 10th century B.C., the 900s. So they're still around. Remember, they lasted till about 700 B.C. They are met with after the exile, that's 586 B.C., still a distinct people, which is a little bit later than 700 B.C. You can see in Nehemiah 13, 23 through 28, the Hittites. The Hebrew merchants exported horses from Egypt not only for the kings of Israel, but also for the Hittites, 1 Kings 10, 28 and 29. From the Egyptian monuments, we learned that the Hittites were people with yellow skins and mongoloid features. Mongol is like Mongolia, Outer Mongolia, which is in Russia, and Inner Mongolia, Neimungu, which is in China. It's called, and Neimungu is translated as Mongol in English, so this is Chinese, basically. The Hittites were people with yellow skins and Chinese features, whose receding foreheads, oblique eyes, and protruding upper jaws are represented as faithfully on their own monuments as they are on those of Egypt, so that we cannot accuse the Egyptian artists of caricaturing their enemies. Now, why would Esau want to marry the Hittite daughters? Probably for political reasons. He wanted to increase his secular power and influence, as John Gill suggests. Now, that would be ironic, given the fact that Esau had sold the wealth he already had. Because remember now, Isaac is loaded. Abraham was loaded. He passed all that wealth to Isaac. Isaac prospered too. He was loaded. And Esau sold it all for a bowl of stew, a lentil stew he traded for his birthright with his brother Jacob. And so now he's resorting to marrying Hittite women in order to get some power, assuming that's true. And on that sad note, we are finished with Genesis chapter 26, verses 23 through 35. We're finished with the whole chapter also. In our next chapter, in the first 29 verses, we will see Isaac blessing Jacob, the younger son, instead of Esau, the older son. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I really hope you enjoyed this one.